Have you registered for the Recruitment Coach Live Summit yet? Here's reason number three why this will be the best investment you make in your business in 2025. You'll discover the latest trends. Listen, the recruitment industry is literally changing before our very eyes. What worked 2 years ago or even last year could already be outdated information. If you want to stay current in terms of the technology, the adoption of AI and automation, and the tactics and strategies that are actually working right now in today's marketplace, then you need to get yourself to London on September 17th or 18th. Do not get left behind. Register now at recruitmentcoach.com/summit.
There's so much power when you say no, and it really shifts psychologically, I think, in the minds of the people you're saying no to, and in your own confidence, you know, that, hey, no, I don't need to do that.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and my special guest today is Tyler Frisby. Tyler is the managing partner of Global Recruiters of McKinney, based in McKinney, Texas. He specializes in recruiting exceptional leadership talent in the environmental and industrial sectors globally. Tyler launched his search firm in 2012 with no prior recruiting experience and has become the number one office in his network out of 195 branches. Welcome, Tyler.
Good morning. How are you, Mark?
I'm brilliant. Thank you so much for being here.
Good stuff, man. Glad to be a part of this show today.
All right.
Appreciate the invite.
My pleasure. And so you were referred by our mutual friend, Rob Bowerman, who's also been on the podcast.
Yes. Great guy. Love
Very Rob. Great guy. And after speaking to you a couple of weeks ago, I understand why he referred me to you. You have an amazing story. Would you mind sharing it?
Yeah, sure, Mark. Happy to share a part of my story. You know, a big part of why I recruit and what I do is for my family, right? As all of us, providing for our families. And so for me and my story, it's best if I go back a little ways as opposed to just jumping in right when I started recruiting, because it all ties together. So that being said, I mean, my journey really began back in 1996, when I had recently completed my sophomore year of high school. I was 16 years old and thought that I had my life under control and that I was really invincible in a lot of ways. I felt at the time I was dating a freshman in college who was a soccer star, smoking hot, and I cared about basketball and girls, you know, and that was it. I didn't care about school or anything like that, and so that was my focus. And all my buddies were jealous that I was dating a college girl that was gorgeous, and so. You know, things were going well. I was playing on the varsity basketball team, excelling. And one night I was talking to Heather, my girlfriend at the time, and I could tell something was off and she wasn't really opening up. And finally, after quite a bit of time, she had disclosed to me that she was pregnant. And that next morning she was planning on going to get an abortion. And I was just immediately humbled and shocked and scared out of my mind and couldn't believe it, and realized for the first time that, well, maybe I don't have everything figured out. Maybe the way I've been living my life has been, not the right way. And so that was really the first time. I just remember falling to my knees and crying out to the Lord Jesus and asking him to give me wisdom and guidance. And so we decided together, after a long conversation and praying together, that we were going to face the situation, and we decided not to proceed with her initial plan. And so that's really when the journey began as far as my work career too, because I ended up having to quit playing hoops and started to work full time after high school, and, you know, work until midnight, second shift in a machine shop, and cutting grass, started a lawn business on the side, whatever I needed to do to start saving money. And ended up graduating high school a year early. And right around that time, I was offered a job to go work for a friend of my father-in-law that owned a recycling business here in the Dallas area, family-owned business, and it's very successful. So they stuck me out in the warehouse initially, and I was on the sorting line, you know, picking through paper and cardboard and riding shotgun on the roll-off trucks, garbage trucks, and front-end load trucks, and just kind of learning the business at the ground level there. And then worked my way into the office and was doing customer service and a little bit of sales here and there, and then moved up to into a full-time sales role and then sales management. And then you know, at the same time, I was going to night school at a community college after I graduated high school about a year early. It was a challenging time, because when I got married when I was 18, and I remember I graduated high school on a Friday, and the very next day, Heather and I got married. Our daughter was 6 months old at the time, and we went on a 9-day honeymoon to San Luis Obispo, California, and came back and started this job and doing the night school thing. And a few years later, had a second daughter, so I got two daughters now. They're 23 and 18. It was tough. I got my college degree during that time. It took me 8 years through the night school program, but got it done, fortunately. And so I'd been at the company, and they were a great company. I learned a lot. I wouldn't be where I am today if it hadn't been for that foundation, you know, learning the environmental space, if it hadn't been for the Getter family, wonderful people. But at the end of the day, I'd been there for almost 15 years, and I didn't have the same last name, right? So I didn't have any equity in the business. And I was ready for a new challenge, and I was commuting a long way into the office, about an hour and a half each way every day. And for some people, that's normal, but for me, it was a strain on my marriage and relationship with my kids and everything, with work responsibilities and everything. So right around that time, my dad introduced me to a gentleman by the name of Eric Jacobson, who a lot of people in the recruiting world might have heard of Eric. He was a successful recruiter for the MRI franchise for a number of years in the IT space, and he ended up selling his business for a lot of money many years ago. And so he was selling franchises for Global Recruiters Network out of Chicago. And so he and I went to lunch, and he asked me, you know, he sensed that I was kind of burnt out where I was at. You know, he asked if I'd ever thought about recruiting. And, you know, I was 33 years old at the time, and really hadn't, you know. And so he strongly considered, you know, encouraged me to consider recruiting. And so I did. And before I knew it, my wife and I were on an airplane flying up to Chicago to learn more. And we met with the GRN team up there, and it turned out they had a lot of, at the time, they had about 179 offices in North America, and they didn't really have any office that specialized within the environmental space. And that was, you know, my background for the last almost 15 years. So I felt like from an industry standpoint, I could add value, but I just needed someone to teach me the recruiting side of things, because I was clueless on that. And I wanted to stay in a space that I knew, and leverage a lot of the contacts that I had made, you know, over the last 15 years, as opposed to just flushing them and, you know, starting something totally different. Cause I liked the environmental space a lot, and I was passionate about it, and we were doing great things. And, but I wanted to be my own boss. I didn't want to have to travel as much, and I wanted to, you know, be responsible for, how much I earned versus someone telling me how much I was worth. And so before we knew it, we ended up taking, against the advice of most people that I respected. at the time, it's different now, my understanding, but at the time it cost, $100,000 to buy a recruiting franchise. And Heather and I didn't have $100K just laying around. And she was a stay-at-home mom. And, we had two kids in Christian private school and one in elementary and one in high school at the time. And I was making a paycheck, steady paycheck every 2 weeks. And so we ended up, I had exactly $100,000 in my 401k. And so we ended up withdrawing every single penny out of that 401k and using it to purchase the franchise. And that's where a lot of my mentors said, "You're an idiot, don't do it." And so it was certainly a leap of faith on many different fronts, but I needed a change, and I believed in the GRN system. But there's two people that supported that in my life at the time. One was my wife Heather, who was very, very supportive. She had recently lost her dad a few months prior, so we were grieving that whole loss heavily, her and her whole family, very unexpected, and it was really, really tough. So she was great, supportive of me despite the grieving that she was going through. And then the other person was my dad. My dad believed that I could be successful in it. He was an entrepreneur himself. He had never worked for anyone else a day in his life, and did well for himself. And so he said, "Hey Ty, if you believe you can do it, man, you should go for it. Don't listen to what these other people are saying." So on that advice and also praying about it, we decided, all right, let's do it. So we invested the money. And at that point there was no looking back, right? I stepped away from the company, gave away a company vehicle and got strong benefits and all that to horrible benefits, being self-employed and going 100% commission. And so very stressful starting out, trying to learn the business. It took 6 months before anything started to happen. Going back when I was 16, when I was at the edge of my bed, just freaking out, a similar feeling at this point in my life, right? I was on my knees a lot thinking, man, is the deal ever going to close? Different circumstances, but the same pit in my stomach feeling, like, oh man, I don't know if I'm doing the right thing. And so fortunately, we closed. The first deal we did was a split with another office. But that gave me some hope. And then the next deal followed, and then the next deal and the next, and it just started to snowball. But yeah, at that point, I think because my wife handles the finances in our home, and we were down to like, I think a little less than $1,000 in our bank account for, that's retirement, that's everything. And I told her, I said, don't tell me how much is in there. It's going to stress me out too much. Just let me focus on, trying to get our name recognition and brand out in the market. And so it was right around that time when the ship started to turn, so to speak, and prayers started to get answered. I do not regret that decision. And if I had to do it all over again, I would, without question. So each year since then, we bought the franchise in April of 2012. It had been a steady incline year over year over year. And within 3.5 years, we paid back our 401k and everything was whole there. And it's been a wild, wild journey. And fortunately for the last couple of years, we finished as a billing manager, finished number one overall in our franchise network. And so just very, very grateful for that. And was able, had the honor and the privilege to join the Pinnacle Society about a year and a half ago. And they've been a very supportive group in addition to the GRN family. And so it's been great, Mark. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of how we came to where we're at today.
Awesome. That is an incredible journey that you've been on and quite unique. I've interviewed a lot of people and I've worked with and had an impact on over 10,000 recruiters in 34 countries. Your story is unique, Tyler. I've not come across that trajectory before, from where you started to where you ended up. I think that is really special. So, you know, that's just amazing, man. That's, you know, I want to talk about the business and like you, how you grew it and how you've steadily improved. That's the part that sure. I'm sure a lot of folks are going to really be interested in. But first, can I just rewind your first ever job? You had to support, you know, your family. You were 16. Did I hear this correctly that your very first job was a garbage man?
Actually, that was my second job. My first job, I worked at a machine shop in Garland, Texas, worked on the assembly line punching rivets.
Oh man!
I was there for about 6 months, and then I left there to become a garbage man. Yes, so I was 18 or so when I started the garbage.
Okay. Wow, that's amazing. So listen, talk to me about your first 6 months in business, because like, you know, your friends and family, apart from your wife and your dad. You know, people are, in general, are risk averse and they don't want to see you get hurt. So they're like telling you you're making a mistake, right? So that's in the back of your mind. You've invested all of your savings. And then things, you know, as you now know, and everybody listening knows, you know, building a new business or a new desk from scratch does take time. And 6 months is probably, you know, probably average for things to start getting traction. But what was going through your mind during that first 6 months when, you know, time is ticking and no deals are happening?
Well, you know, accountability was important for me during that time, right? And staying close to GRN team to keep me encouraged through those dark days. And, you know, they kept telling me, fake it till you make it, fake it till you make it. And, because you know, people want to do business with people who they feel are successful, right?
Sure.
And when things aren't happening, boy, it's hard to feel like you're just getting your teeth kicked in, and there's so much discouragement from so many different angles. And but all it takes is one phone call to turn that that negativity around, right?
Yes. I mean,
you just need one yes. And so that's what I really focused on. And I started at, you know, lower level searches, you know, sales reps, mechanics, you know, thing. Cause I had no confidence and I didn't, you know, I was agreeing to, fee agreements that I would never even think about today, you know, as it pertains to my compensation and whatnot. And it just to try to get some experience under my belt or whatever. And I made a lot of mistakes, you know, made a ton of mistakes. One of them was initially when my wife and I got into this business, the plan was we were going to work it together. And she was going to focus more on the candidate side. I was going to focus more on the client side. And it was out of her comfort zone too, right? And so first, you know, we get back from training, franchise. We had 2 weeks of franchise training up in Chicago. We come back to McKinney, and we set her office up in the media room, and mine down in the study downstairs. And she does a great job, works her butt off. You know, and she comes into my office, and you know, is kind of going over some stuff she's been doing. And stupid me, I go right to telling her where she could improve as opposed to thanking her for the job that she did. You're so wonderful. I love you so much. Right. Mm. And instead of that initial approach, I went to the criticism, and she looked at me and she gave me a nice warm smile and she said, "You're on your own, and I love you, and this is not for me." And she walked out and she never picked up a phone ever again. And so in hindsight, it was the right thing to do anyway, because she just, you know, she wasn't, her heart wasn't in it, and she was doing it just to be supportive of me. Now, she does, she's a former CFO of a high-end steakhouse, and she knows numbers really well. And so she handles all of our bookkeeping, taxes, works with our CPA, you know, keeps the IRS off of our back and payroll, does all that, right? And I'm horrible at that. And so without her spending those, 5 hours a week doing that stuff, it would be in a world of hurt. So
that's funny.
I'll take what I can get, right?
Right.
And that is a good one for me. But that was a mistake early on. You know, if I could do it over again, that is one area that I would have done differently.
Well, it's funny because that's a good lesson for coaching team members in general, right? And but especially you can't coach your spouse. It's a difficult position. We have a similar arrangement. My wife works part-time working on, office and financial management, because I'm similar to you. I'm better at the selling and, working with clients, but not strong at the, at the financial management. So so it's good to know your limitations and compensate for those and bring people with complementary skills on board, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we make a really good team now. So we're in our groove.
All right. Excellent. So what did you specifically do during those 6 months in order to, start doing deals, getting traction, making money?
Yeah. So I was on the phone a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where the foundation was laid, being on the phone and finding a strong candidate and taking that candidate and marketing it to various organizations within the space. And, it's exhausting. I still do that occasionally, not as much currently today, but early on, that's how it happened. And then, but what I noticed, Mark, was, whenever a deal did close, it wasn't, I was happy about it. I was grateful for it. Don't get me wrong. Right. I mean, we needed anything we could get, right, to pay bills and get the family, kind of back on track, so to speak. And so, but it seemed like when I was recruiting these salespeople, man, that was a whole lot of work and not a great amount of compensation. Mm-hmm. And they're so flaky a lot of times, and they're not always telling you the truth, and not that other candidates do, but salespeople in general, I thought were worse. And I'm a salesperson myself, so anyway, so I kept thinking, man, I want to do bigger deals, right?
Yeah.
I want to, if I'm going to go through all this effort, I'd rather work on larger assignments and get paid more. And so that was a transition. That was a shift. Probably I started working on, 2 years after being in the business. And again, it was a fake it till you make it kind of thing. And,
yep.
And I remember I went to an industry trade show, cause I like to mix it up, meet people. I'm fairly good in person, or I feel like I'm a lot better in person than I am over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so relationships for me is kind of the key to my business today and getting it started as well. And for me, there's no better way of doing that than meeting people face to face. But you have to be very strategic how you do it. You can waste a lot of time going to the wrong events, the wrong things. And so I was kind of figuring that out too, early on. Okay, what is worth my time? What isn't? Some events cost money. I didn't have any money at the time. And I was like, what do I invest in? What do I not? So on and so forth. So I went to a large industry trade show. And at that show, a buddy of mine, this was in Atlanta, Georgia, suggested, gave me an invite only to a bank party that later that night. And this was like day two of the trade show. And I went there by myself. It was a massive exhibit hall, and I was just working the trade show. I mean, just I was exhausted, right? I would get there, you know, 15 minutes before the door opened, and then I would leave as it was closing, just working every booth, just going down every aisle, and it was exhausting. Had a ton of business cards. Well, at the end of that second day, I was whooped, man, and I had a small handful of job orders, but you know, nothing exciting, all, you know, lower level stuff. And I was like, man, this is just beating. And so he gives me this invite. I'm like, I don't want to go to a bank party. I mean, why would I want to go to a bank party? I mean, this, what a waste of time. I should just go back to the hotel, you know, eat early dinner and go to bed, rest up for the next day. Cause it was a 4-day deal. And I thought, no, I'll just go. And I remember sitting out in my car in the parking garage, and I almost just drove back to the hotel. You know, I came just inches from doing that. And I thought, no, I'll go up there for 10, 15 minutes, just see what it's like. If it's a, you know, a waste of time, I'll just leave and, you know, go home. So, or go back to the hotel. So I went up there, and, man, it was a game changer. It was all C-suite and CFOs, CEOs, COOs, private equity guys, all in the same room, probably 300 or 400 of them. And I was the only recruiter in the room. And I got there right when it opened, and I stayed until they shut it down, and met some phenomenal people, some of which are still clients to this day.
Wow.
This is back in 2014. And I think I left there with 6 job orders and good projects too. Exciting stuff. Stuff that I wanted to work on, right? And I befriended one of the lenders, one of the bank guys that was there at the function. And he happened to live in Dallas. I live in Dallas. And he was about my same age, younger guy. And so he knew everybody in my space, like all the decision makers, right? He was working with all the CFOs. He was working with all the CEOs because he was lending them money for their business. And I was thinking, and I was like, that's the guy I need to connect with, because he can introduce me to some people at a higher level to get me in the door to some of these places.
Kind yes.
of thing, right. So that was so we got back to Dallas. I took him to lunch. We became close personal friends in addition to business colleagues. We still go hunting together a couple times a year, and our wives are good friends too. And so, but you know, I didn't go into it like, I went into it with a servant mindset of how can I help Jake, right?
Yes.
And I didn't go into it like, hey buddy, hook me up, you know. that was not my approach. My approach was you know, because he needs business too, right? And I
yeah.
need work. And so I shared with him my stuff way before I even asked him anything about his.
And good policy.
Really, you know, some people would frown upon that, but I you know, at the end of the day, people, like I said earlier, like to do business. Actually, I don't know if I said this, but people like to do business with people they like, right? And it's all about relationships. And you know, if another recruiter calls a client that I have a really good relationship with, I don't feel threatened, you know, because my clients are loyal and they like the work that I do. And so I wasn't concerned about sharing data with Jake. And ironically, later on, a couple of years later, I placed him as a CFO in a
oh, that's funny.
A platform private equity backed company, and because he always wanted to be a CFO, and so he's out of the banking business now, and he's working for a private equity company, but it's just it's cool how, man, I came so close not going to that function, and it literally was a game changer
for wow. me. Since you're listening to this podcast, it tells me that you're someone who's interested in personal growth and business improvement. That's something we have in common. I really enjoy listening to podcasts, reading and listening to business books, watching TED Talks, But by far the most important investment I've made in my own development has been working with a coach. It started back in 1999, 2000, when I was working as a recruiter. I hired a coach and he helped me to double my billings in 90 days. It sounds corny, but it was really a life-changing experience. Since then, I've worked with various coaches almost continuously over the years, and it's made a massive difference to my own personal and business success. In fact, that first experience of working with a coach was the catalyst for me ultimately deciding that much as I loved recruitment, my true purpose was to become a coach and enable others to achieve their full potential. Fast forward to today, and I work with recruitment business owners to help them escape the feast and famine roller coaster and create consistent, predictable billings. If you'd like to know more, you can apply for a free strategy session at recruitmentcoach.com/breakthrough. Couple of things I'm taking from that story. One is, you know, to always be open to opportunity, and you never know, like that next phone call, you know, could change your life, right? That next event or conversation. And so when you start each day, whether it's you're thinking like in the mindset you said, who can I help today? Or who can I serve today? Or how can I add value today? And I'm curious to know, I wonder what interesting people and opportunities are going to cross my path today. And just kind of bringing that mindset. And of course, you're not always going to feel like making the call or doing whatever it is. But, sure, you know, if you have that approach, then, you know, you'll opportunities come to you, right? The other thing I liked about that story is your attitude to the referral partnership with your friend Jake. Is I've had tons of joint ventures and referral partnerships over the years. It's one of the main ways that I've grown my business. And I think you always need to go into it thinking that you want to make it so that you're giving more than you're receiving, or that the other person is getting more value than you. If you can structure it that way or approach it with that mindset, then and really like seriously try to give value to your partners, then it's going to come back.
Absolutely. Yeah, without question. That's I believe in that wholeheartedly, Mark.
Yeah. So interesting. So that was a game changer for you. That kind of helped you to move up the value chain and start working on bigger searches, higher value stuff, more interesting stuff. And so how did things progress from there? Because that's still a long way from becoming, you know, the number one billing manager in the network. You know, what were the key stages there?
Good question. And so, you know, a big part of what we do is people need to know who we are, right? And in our particular niches that we work, and you know, name recognition, your brand recognition is important. Because ideally, I didn't want to have to be the one initiating phone calls every time. It'd be nice for some people to call me, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to me doing all the calling. Yeah. That was my goal, right? Is it's less of a beatdown if you're not having to, you know, make all the calls. And so, I leveraged that initial network, right? I mean, one of my franchise offices, Brian Stracer, I remember sitting in a meeting and the comment that he made was leverage everything, right? Leverage everything. And so I always try to remember that when I'm on a call, you know, okay, what else could we do here? What other ideas can come from this or what have you? So, but you have to be intentional about it. You have to remember it. And I don't always do that, but I tried to adopt that. And so another kind of a ballsy thing that I did that a lot of people would disagree with was there's a trade show publication that is big in my space, and I befriended the executive publisher of that group, and really good guy, and became a personal friend too. But you know, he has the media outlet to the entire space, right?
Yes.
And I thought, well, how could I, you know, And so I helped him with some introductions to some organizations that he was having a hard time getting into, and personal introductions, and, you know, shared my info with him. And, you know, and I didn't really know him that well at the time, but I just kind of went out on faith that, hey, this, you know, this was the right thing to do to help him. And so in return, which I didn't know he was going to do this at all, but he started a private equity kind of a conference, an annual thing, with my input and help on who he should invite to the function, because I knew a lot of those guys at this point, and it made me a sponsor, like a executive level sponsor, but free of charge, and allowed me to, you know, get my name out and in front of the audience and whatnot. And whenever I do a high level deal that's not confidential in nature, because a lot of the stuff I work on is confidential, so I can't share a ton of stuff. But I will send out a press release through his media outlets, right, to the entire industry, and he'll put on his newsletter and what have you. And then I'll send it out through my database, just kind of announcing a deal that we recently closed, and just congratulating the candidate and the client, kind of a thing. And so, but it helps with that name recognition, that brand recognition in the space of people just being reminded that, hey, we're doing deals. I would get a lot of email inquiries from hiring managers saying, hey, thanks for letting me know about this. You know, by the way, I need a CFO over here. Can you help me? Kind of a thing.
Brilliant.
And so that has paid off in spades as well. And I haven't had to market a candidate in, I don't remember how long it's been now. So, it's just all about the relationships and the connections and the, it was quite a shift, you know, from how I started out doing the business and that way. But I had to do that to learn it. Right.
Of course.
Cause there's fundamentals. Like when I qualify a candidate, I know it's going to take 45 minutes to do it the right way.
Yeah.
You know, I always start on the personal side. Cause they need to know that you care about them as a person, right? Before you even talk about business. I don't care if you're talking to a CFO who's normally just numbers driven, or if it's a VP, it doesn't matter. It's you gotta connect with them on a personal level. And then when you do that, they're more apt to want to help you too. Right. And not that you're, you know, asking for it, but they'll help you without you even asking. So, you know, there's nuts and bolts to the recruiting process that GRN taught me, you know, right out of the gate, that has been invaluable.
Brilliant. A couple of things I wanted to pick up on that you said. One is, you know, getting to know people personally and so that they know that you like them is interesting, because there's a book by Robert Cialdini called Influence. Have you read this?
I have not, no.
It's definitely interesting. You can find a sort of summary on YouTube, which is good. It's one of those animated summaries where they're drawing pictures to go along with the presentation. That gives you a 10-minute primer on influence. But it's a great book. American psychology professor Robert Cialdini wrote this book called Influence. And what's interesting, one of the principles in the book, I think there's seven principles of influence. One is getting away from the idea that you need everyone to like you, and actually reversing that, because what influences people is actually showing that you like them, not trying to get people to like you. And it's impossible to make somebody else like you, right? That you can't control that, but you can control, you know, demonstrating to them that you like them. And so, because if they feel that they like, that you like them, they're more likely to trust you and, you know, follow your advice is the principle behind it. So,
Good. That's good. Yeah. And another thing that reminds me of something that happened right before I got in the recruiting business There's an Italian, you know, the Italians in the garbage business, there's a lot of them, right? There's one of my customers at my former job was a Genentasio was his last name. Yeah, good Italian last name. And he and I worked on some joint projects together, and he could tell that I was a people pleaser, and it bothered him. Because he wasn't that way. You know, he was a very successful business guy, and so one time I was at lunch with him or something, and he looks at me and he goes, "Tyler, I want to give you some advice." I said, "What's that, Frank?" He said, "If everybody loves you, you're not doing anything." And I said, First, like, I don't know if that's true. And the more I thought about it, I was like, well, yeah, it is kind of true. And so I've had to adjust my thinking, you know, along those lines. And it's been actually revolutionary for me applying that to my business today. Cause I do have a tendency to want people to like me. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the right way to look at things. So yeah, what you just shared is great. I'm going to check out that book.
It's interesting what you said about if everybody likes you, it means you're not doing enough, right? You're not putting yourself out there enough. What you'd said something to me in a previous, I think it was in an email, about not being afraid to say no to business. Can you speak a little on that?
Yeah. That was something, that was definitely a transition, right? From early in my recruiting career to now. I said yes to everything, right? Because I wanted to get experience. So, you know, and I learned a lot of hard lessons in doing that. And, you know, working for cheap and working for just jerks and people that I didn't like. And, but I felt like I had to do it because, you know, I don't know. I was a little trigger happy to use it. You know, I did whatever I could get. You know, whatever I could do, I'd do. But man, but there's so much power when you say no,
right?
And it really shifts psychologically. I think in the minds of the people you're saying no to, and in your own confidence. You know that hey, no, I don't need to do that particular assignment, or you know. And the assignment could be a great assignment, except for one aspect of the assignment, right? That could just tank the whole thing. And as you, you know, do this business more and more, you learn, you know, what are the most important things, like sense of urgency,
yeah.
Right? If there's not a sense of urgency, don't waste your time on it. I learned that again and again and again.
Yeah, no kidding. That
the urgency is going to get higher, and it doesn't, and I'm an idiot again, you know. So I've learned that lesson
so
many times. I still occasionally and do it. Gosh darn it! But I you know, I'm much better at it now than identifying it and moving on to something else because there's just more stuff to work on. And
what would
so
you
now? It's like,
go ahead.
I actually enjoy saying no.
Interesting. So it gets easier with practice.
Yeah. Yeah, and the things that you do say yes to, you feel like, man, you can really put your shoulder into it. You know, you can really because, you know, I try to focus my projects to three, no more than five at a time, right? As far as the assignments I'm working on, I really like to have three, and I have one. I always have some one-offs here and there that I have kind of going, but anything outside of that, because I'm a solo off practitioner, right? I don't have a you know, recruiters and search consultants or so. I don't have any of that. It's just me. And so that's even more important to be selective in the assignments that I take on. And so yeah, being able to say no. And my wife has helped me with that too. She's like, "Is that really a good idea? What, you know?"
So Tyler, what
a great sounding board.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. What would be some examples of things that you would now say no to?
Anything below a 30% fee.
Okay, cool.
Example.
Yeah.
Don't waste my time.
Mm-hmm. Before you go on, can I just touch on that? Like, because this issue came up. I've got a coaching group called Inner Circle of recruiting firm owners, and we have a private Facebook group. And one of the questions that came up yesterday is on fee negotiation, because this gentleman had an opportunity to get 6 searches with the same company, but they wanted a discount. And so he was, you know, he wants that business. It's ideal for him. It's right in his wheelhouse. And, you know, under the current circumstances, people are lighter, you know, business is slow for a lot of people. So what I was going to ask is that rule firm even in the era of COVID-19, or like, what's your stance on that?
Yeah, no, it's still, well, I work in an essential business, right? So even if there's a pandemic, garbage still needs to be picked up.
Right.
So sure. Whether it's at the home or at the office or wherever mm-hmm. it is, it's, and so, that for me personally, I don't feel like I have to, give discounts like that. And I'm still getting calls for people needing help, but there's been a lot of upgrade needs in the space. You know, when times get tight like this, the bad apples come to the surface quicker within organizations, right? And so hiring managers and owners that are serious about looking forward to the future and not just what's happening today, you know, they will invest the money to make the proper upgrades sooner rather than later, right? And take advantage of some of the talent that might be available now that or might be more open to listening now than they were when times were robust, right? And great. So
yeah.
So that's when I'm talking to hiring managers, that's kind of the seed that I'm planting in their minds is, you know, that kind of, you know, hey, things are crazy now. But you know, let's look, what's this going to look like a year from now? You know, you have an opportunity to get this amazing candidate. And so let's just go ahead and do it now. Cause you know, a year from now, there's going to be, you know, 6 other people knocking on his door. And so I don't know if that makes sense, but that's,
yeah. No, I'm with you. I'm with you.
But yeah, so go back to the fee thing, you know, yeah. Even like the multiple, the tiered thing. I don't do a lot of those because I'm doing executive level stuff, right? So I don't have like, hey, I need 6 CFOs, right? It's they're one at a time type of assignments. And so I don't feel like I need to, you know, give discounts. You know, early on in my recruiting, I did have, you know, a client say, hey, I need to hire 4 salespeople. I want a discount. And at the time, my franchise instructed me, okay, charge them 30% for the first one, you know, 29% for the second, 28%, 20%, you know, go down that way.
Yeah.
And then on the fifth one, it starts back over, kind of a thing, right? At the beginning of the new year, it starts back over. So you don't box yourself into doing the rest of your deals with them at 27% or whatever
right.
it is. You know what I mean? And Makes so that, sense. That was the advice that they gave me. Anyway, yeah. So
no, that's cool. I interrupted your flow. We were talking about what to walk away from. So your criteria is, you know, anything less than 30%. What else is something that you would walk away from?
I asked all my hiring managers, you know, on a scale from 1 to 10, 10 being the highest, how would you rank the sense of urgency? If they give me anything less than an 8, I will typically walk away.
Yep.
I use the 1 to 10 scale a lot. I would encourage other recruiters to do the same.
Yeah.
After when I'm doing a, you know, a debrief after an interview, I ask the candidates the same thing. Hey, on a scale from 1 to 10, now that you know what you know about the opportunity, how would you rank this particular opportunity? You know, it's such a good way to gauge where people's head is at. So they tell you, you know, a 6 was okay. Thanks. You know, why did you say 6? You know, and then they tell you the reasons why they're concerned or whatever. It is just a really good barometer for me. And, I would encourage others to.
It's funny. Tap into the exact same thing, Tyler. I probably shouldn't say this on the, tell my secret here, but you'd think it's kind of obvious, like if you'd stop and think about it. So if people want to talk to me about coaching, then they need to apply for a strategy session with me, where we talk about their goals and their challenges, and we sketch out a roadmap for how they can, you know, move past those challenges and achieve the goals. And one of the questions on that questionnaire is, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the highest, how motivated are you to achieve your goals? Now, if someone is not motivated to achieve their goals, they don't need a coach, right? There's no way you'd hire someone if you're not passionate and really like compelled to achieve those goals. And it's funny, I was funny when people filled the form, if they put anything less than, as you say, 8 or 9, then you're thinking, why would I spend time with this person? It just wouldn't, that wouldn't be productive for either of us. So yeah. I think it can be useful.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. That's good. Yeah. Another criteria, I think of it, it's quite frank, this may or may not be wise, but if I don't like the person,
yeah,
like
I agree.
If they come across as arrogant or, you know, just too, if I get the sense that they're going to be too difficult to work with, right? Or if I know they have a bad reputation in the industry and, you know, they've been known to screw people on payment or whatever, you know, like I just, you know, life is too short to in my mind, to waste time on dealing with people. And I had another a fellow Pinnacle guy tell me, well, yeah, Tyler, but you know, their money is green too. And I get it, you know, I've taken, I took an assignment just recently and that was the one thing that I was unsure about, is like, is this person going to be a jack wagon to work with? And they were, it was a very difficult assignment, but was able to get it done. And he ended up, unbeknownst to me, he referred another CEO private equity guy that he was on the board of. And I didn't realize that this guy that was a kind of a jerk, he was on 4 boards, right? And all within my industry. And he was spreading good things to some people that needed help finding talent. And so that was, you know, I got an assignment from him and did that deal. But I didn't even know he referred me until I asked the CEO. I said, "How'd you find out about me?" And he told me that guy referred him over to me. So I was like, "Ah, okay." Well,
that's funny. Sometimes first impressions are wrong, right? So
yes,
I think it's okay to give people the benefit of the doubt, and then after you work with them, you know whether you want to continue working with them. I mean, sometimes you can tell right away, right, that this person is not going to be a good fit for you, and you should just, you know, refer them to someone else or point them in a different direction. But sometimes you don't know until after you work with them.
Yeah. And another criteria, now that I'm thinking of it, is if the firm is working with another recruiting agency on the same assignment, I will pass.
Yes.
I just won't waste my time on that. I've been burned on that too many times.
Agreed.
And I just, it's just got to be, it's about relationship, right? They have to, I do, you know, my average fee last year was $85,000. And, but I don't do retained, traditional retained work, right? Like I don't charge anything up front to do my search.
Interesting. Okay.
And a lot of people say, hey, you're an idiot. And I get it. But what I do require in my agreements is that they'll work with me exclusively.
Yeah.
You know, I tell them that, and a lot of these people maybe I haven't worked with before, so they don't really know me either, you know, and I just tell them, hey, I think you should pay for results, not effort. And if I'm not going to send you my invoice until the project is finalized in return, I want you to work with me exclusively. And in addition to that, if you get any candidates referred to you outside of my efforts, I expect you to funnel those through my process as well, so we can include them on the same playing field with everybody else.
Yes.
So and so they agree to that as well. And so I, you know, I do things that lower my risk, but it's, at the end of the day, it's on me to deliver, right? And our clients want speed and they want accuracy, right? And we're not resume factories and we can't operate like that. And so, but what I'm most after is their referral when the project is done, right? That's because that's what keeps your name in good light with folks.
Yes.
Is when you do a good job, you want to be able to use them as a reference, right? And so I would rather have that than take, you know, percentage up front, and Tyler, competing against the Korn Ferries of the world, right, and the Spencer Stewarts that do require that money up front on a new client. You know, for them, it could be perceived as less risky if they work with someone like myself, because I'm not requiring them to give me money up front when we haven't done anything together before, because I don't have the Korn Ferry name, right? Like, I love going up against those guys because it's a blast. But anyway, I'm going on a tangent. I apologize.
No, that's all right. I want to pick up on that. I wish we had more time because I would like to dig into this with you. I would encourage you to reconsider your stance on that, actually, Tyler, regarding, I think you should be charging a deposit because the exclusivity is great, but what happens if you're 6 or 8 weeks into the search and the client says, oh, never mind, we're decided not to go ahead after all, and you've already put a lot of time and effort into that, then, you know, then you come away with nothing, right? So I'm a huge advocate of, not necessarily like the Korn Ferry are going to charge you the fee regardless of whether or not you fill the job, right? They're just going to, you're going to pay the full fee. And it's invoiced in like every 30 days or whatever in tranches. But for you to work primarily on a results basis, but with a deposit of some kind, which is then deducted from the final invoice, I think that's a really happy compromise for both you and the client to show that, you know, they're committed. You're going to put, you know, a ton of effort into this search, and you just want to know that they're serious and they're committed to the process. That's kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah, no, that's good advice. I appreciate you offering that, Mark.
So, well, look, that's maybe we can pick up on that conversation another day, Tyler. I've really enjoyed chatting with you today, and you know, please come back again some other time because this was fun.
Yeah. No, thanks for having me, Mark. Appreciate you so much, and look forward to staying in touch.
Yeah. Hey, listen. Just before I go, two things I wanted to ask you. Well, one thing I wanted to share with you because I think you might appreciate that, and I sometimes do a stoic moment on this kind of segment on this show. And so let me share that with you as well. This is from Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor. And now, forgive me, I don't speak Latin, so I don't know if my pronunciation is good, but he has an expression, memento mori, which is remember that you are mortal. So he says, this is from book 2 of the Meditations, you may leave this life at any moment. Have this possibility in your mind in all that you do or say or think. And, you know, he was really big on this idea of every day, all the time, reminding yourself of your own mortality and letting that guide and influence your thinking, the way you behave, the way you interact, the decisions you make. And I thought that was pretty powerful.
Yeah, that's good, man.
Awesome.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
So Tyler, you said to me on another occasion, am I right, your daughter studied over here in Scotland?
She did, yeah, in Edinburgh.
Cool. And
sure did. And she was there a year and a half ago, I think.
Okay. Amazing. I mean, such a weird coincidence because that's where I live, just outside of Edinburgh. What made her choose of all the places in the world to come here?
Yeah, good question. So when she graduated high school, we have a kind of a deal with our girls that when you graduate high school, we'll take you on a trip, right, to celebrate your graduation. Anywhere in the world, you get to pick. And so Riley, my oldest, picked Europe. She wanted to do Scotland and Ireland and England, you know, kind of road trip that way. And so we really stumbled upon Edinburgh on that trip, right, after her senior year of high school, and we drove through it, and she just fell in love with the city, and she was like, man, I would love to come back here and spend more time here, because we were only there initially for a couple of nights, and so the opportunity surfaced, you know, when she was a junior in college. She was looking at the abroad programs, and one of them was in Edinburgh, and she said, I'm going there. It was an easy decision for her. And sure enough, that's what she ended up doing. So what she did was she saved her elective. She didn't use her. A lot of people, college students, take their elective classes, you know, freshman, sophomore year, to kind of get them out of the way. Well, she elected to do the harder stuff earlier. So then she took her electives when she was at Edinburgh so she could have more fun.
Cool.
And have less intense classes, you know, overseas. And so, so that's the approach that she took, and it ended up being a really good one for her.
That's awesome. Well, listen, if you ever come back this way on a family trip or otherwise, then let's get together. It'd be fun to meet up.
Oh, I'd love that. Yeah, awesome. That'd be awesome.
All right, Tyler. Well, look, thanks very much again for being on the show, and thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. If you've enjoyed the show, the best way you can show your support is to click that subscribe button. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.